Well, welcome to our session, Addressing Vaccine Hesitancy Through a Risk Communication Framework. My name is Mary McCauley, and I work in CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases in the Office of Communication. And what I'll do today is introduce each of our presenters, and we'll have our two presentations. And if you'll hold your questions, we'll take questions at the end of our session. Our first speaker is Allison Singer. Allison is founder and president of the Autism Science Foundation, a not-for-profit organization launched in April 2009 to support autism research. And as you know, if you saw a session that she did earlier today, she's very plugged into autism research. And lists aren't usually very interesting, but I've got an impressive list that I want to read to you. In 2007, Ms. Singer was appointed by HHS Secretary Leavitt to serve as one of six public members of the Federal Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, charged with writing a strategic plan to guide federal spending for autism research. Her other current committee and board memberships are extensive, and they include the National Institute of Mental Health's Alliance for Research Progress, the Executive Board of the Yale Child Studies Center Associates Committee, the External Advisory Board of the Autism Baby Sibling Research Consortium, the Board of Directors of Mental Health News, the American Academy of Pediatrics New York State Immunization Coalition, and the Westchester County Autism Advisory Council. She's here today to talk to us from her experience about making the case for vaccines, a strategy for communicating vaccine safety data to parents. Please help me in welcoming Allison.
Thank you so much. Before I get started talking about the new framework that we've developed for communicating vaccine safety to parents, I want to talk a little bit about how we got to the point that we are today. And it really, the questions that parents are presenting with regard to vaccine safety and vaccine hesitancy tend to cluster around three concerns. The first is the MMR vaccine. The second is thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative used in some vaccines, although not anymore. And now the latest is the too many, too soon. Kids get too many vaccines. They get them too early in their life. Wouldn't it be better to spread them out? So just a little bit of additional background. With regard to the MMR, this really stems from a publication in The Lancet back in 1996 by a researcher in Great Britain, Andrew Wakefield, who published a study indicating that MMR could be a cause of autism. Later, several of his co-authors retracted the study, and eventually the entire study earlier this year was retracted by The Lancet. Nonetheless, once you ring the bell, it's hard to unring it. And this set off a tremendous scare. And I'm sure many of you realize that MMR compliance rates plummeted. And of course, we then saw a rise in mumps, measles, and rubella. This despite the fact that there have been multiple studies looking at MMR with regard to autism, none of which show any causal relationship between MMR vaccine and autism. Then in 2009, we talked a little bit about this morning about the omnibus hearings, which again really slammed the door on any issue of causation between a causal relationship between autism and the MMR. With regard to thimerosal, this was really if it's not MMR, maybe it's the thimerosal in vaccines. So not the vaccines themselves, but some of the components included in vaccines. The AAP, I'm sure, again, many of you are aware, recommended that thimerosal be removed from vaccines to, quote, make safe vaccines safer, which was not in my opinion, a terrific choice of words. If the vaccines are safe, how does removing thimerosal make them safer? So that set off a lot of confusion, really led to the birth of several of the anti-vaccine groups that are focused around mercury and thimerosal. The key pieces of data here to look at is the fact that once thimerosal was removed from vaccines, if it were the cause of autism, you would expect to see a decline in the rate of diagnosis of autism. And in fact, we have not seen that. The rate has, in fact, gone up. In addition to that, there have also been multiple studies looking specifically at thimerosal in relation to autism, and none of them indicate a causal relationship between thimerosal and autism. And then again, in the second round of omnibus autism hearings, looking at the question of thimerosal, the court again really gave a very strongly worded statement with regard to the fact that there is absolutely no evidence to support the idea that thimerosal causes autism. So given all of that, why are we still talking about autism and vaccines when the science clearly shows no link? And it's really because the goalposts continue to move. Now it's not just thimerosal, but also maybe mercury in our air and in our water that might cause autism. We heard this morning, maybe it's the aluminum in vaccines, not the thimerosal. There have been some reports that maybe it's the hepatitis B vaccine, given the birth dose, that causes autism. The fact that we can now start to diagnose children at 6 weeks really doesn't mean that it's not vaccines, because children are getting that birth dose. And also, we continue to hear too many too soon, it's too much for a young immune system to process. I think it's also been a very sticky story because the media loves controversy. The media want to set up a he said, she said. They like stories where it's scientists say this, but the moms say this. It's a very compelling media story when you have a mother who goes on television and says, my son was fine, then he got this shot, and the life left his eyes, and he became a ghost. Those anecdotes are very compelling to the media, and they continue to perpetuate those stories. And also, the anti-vaccine movement now has a celebrity spokesperson who likes to brag about the fact that she earned her PhD in vaccinology at the University of Google. The thinking really has been the fact that this story is still sticking around despite the existence of very good science suggests that this could be a problem of communication. So that's why we wanted to talk about new strategies for communicating science. The good news is that based on focus groups and parent reporting, 85% of parents say they want to be convinced that vaccines are safe. Just show them the data in a respectful way. And they actually make the decision, the final decision, in the doctor's office after consultation with their healthcare professional. And they believe the information that they receive from pediatricians and from healthcare professionals. So those are all very strong reasons to continue to try to convince those parents who are vaccine hesitant. Traditionally, in Communications 101, when you're talking about communicating science, it's really a two-step process. You identify the information that's needed in order to make the decision. You formulate the message based on that data, and you communicate it. So in this case, if we were to follow the traditional communication paradigm, we would simply say to parents, there's no data that supports a causal relationship between vaccines and autism. Here are the studies. We know vaccines save lives. Your child needs to be vaccinated. But that's not enough. So at the Autism Science Foundation, we've developed a new four-step framework that's really based on the concerns that parents are expressing to us, what they say they want to hear, the reasons they describe for why they have difficulty talking to their doctors, listening to their healthcare professionals. The first step really focuses on trying to set the right tone for the conversation. And actually, we're calling it the case model, making the case for vaccines. I presented this once before, and I didn't have an acronym, and everyone said, oh, you have to have an acronym. So now we have an acronym. The first step is really to find something on which you can agree with the parents. Acknowledge their concern, find some point with which you can agree with them. And I'm going to go through a few case studies where I'll go through some of the top concerns that parents raise and we'll apply this model. So you'll see what I mean by finding some statement with which everyone can agree. The second step is really to talk about what you as the healthcare professional have done to build your knowledge base and expertise. And this really responds to the concern that parents have where they say, you know, I tried to talk to my doctor, but he knows nothing about autism. He's not interested in finding more information. I tried to give my doctor information, but she didn't really want to read it. So this step is really to say to parents, I know this is important. It's important to me too. And here's what I've personally done to make sure that I'm up on the latest information. The third step is then to get into the science. And we talked a little bit more specifically about the science around autism earlier this morning. And then the fourth step is really to then give your advice based on the science. And the fourth step really should be advise, but then the model would be called CASA. So it's now explain advise, so we can say it's the case model. Okay, the reason we're convinced based on the data that this is going to work is people tend to behave rationally when certain parameters are in place. When they get relevant information in a concise and comprehensive format that makes sense to them. Secondly, they behave rationally when they feel that their concerns have been heard. And Ari talked a little bit about this morning. She said that the key to being a good communicator is to be a good listener. And that's really the same point that I'm making here. People want to feel that their concerns were heard and taken seriously. Thirdly, they behave rationally when they feel that they have some control over the decision, that they've engaged in a productive dialogue. And fourth, they don't want to feel like their concerns were belittled. They want to feel that their healthcare professional is taking their concerns very seriously, and in fact, takes the entire issue very seriously. And so the upshot here is that parents are not only evaluating the message, they're also evaluating the way in which the message is delivered. There are definitely barriers to this conversation, and the first is that there's never enough time with each patient. I know there are some families who have so many concerns that they want to be in the office for 45 minutes to an hour talking about these concerns, and there's no reimbursement for this. So that's absolutely a barrier. It's very hard to compete with the media. You know, we are not Oprah. And I know that some healthcare professionals have said, there's no way that I can compete with Jenny McCarthy, but we have to try. Third is that parents come in with bad information. You know, the internet is the great equalizer, and I hear all the time that parents come in with Dr. Bob's alternative vaccine schedule photocopied from the back of his book, and they say, this is the schedule that I want. So you're already starting out from a difficult position. And finally, anecdotes are very powerful. That's why the media loves anecdotes. It's very hard to compete with my friend told me that she gave her son the MMR and the next day he was autistic. You know, how do you, what do you say? I'm sorry. Okay, so I'm going to go through our case model, looking at the top three parent concerns about vaccines and showing how we would apply this model. The first is, do vaccines cause autism? The second is, well, the diseases aren't so bad. Isn't it just better to fight them naturally than to get vaccines? And the third is the Dr. Bob schedule. There's just too many vaccines too soon, and let's slow down the schedule so that my beautiful baby daughter's immune system is not overwhelmed. So here's the first one. I heard on TV that vaccines cause autism. So the statement of corroboration is, well, there's certainly been a lot of coverage on television about vaccines and autism, so I can understand why you have questions. And I think that's an example of trying to find something with which you can agree, so that you're starting off the conversation in the right tone and spirit, that you're not adversaries, but you're partners in taking care of your patient's health. It's not always easy to find something with which you can agree, but I think it's a very important step. The second, the about me, is I always want to make sure I'm up to date on the latest information so that I can do what's best for my patients. So I've researched this thoroughly. And again, those of you in this room can say, in fact, I just returned from a professional conference where we talked about these particular issues. That says to parents, you're not asking me a stupid question. I think this is a very important topic, and so I've spent personal time researching this issue and learning as much as I can. And then based on that learning, then jump into the science. But I think many of us get so frustrated when parents come in and they say, I don't want to get vaccines, that we just launch right into the science. You know, oh, there's no proof that vaccines cause autism. And I think this is one of the reasons why we have to do these two earlier steps so that parents are in a better position to actually receive and hear the science when it's presented to them. So the third step is really to talk about the science. The scientific evidence does not support a causal link. The CDC, the AAP, the NIH, the IOM have all reviewed the data and all reached the same conclusion. There are dozens of studies that have now been done, and none show a causal link between autism and vaccines. And then give your advice to the patients. Vaccines are critical. Choosing not to vaccinate does not protect children from autism, but it does leave them open to life-threatening diseases. And so in our practice, we strongly believe that kids need to get these vaccines because we love kids, we care about kids, and this is best practice. So here's a second example. Measles isn't so bad, and I had chickenpox and I was fine. So the statement of corroboration is, I can understand why you might feel this way. I had chickenpox myself. The second, about me would be, the vaccine program has been so successful that until last year, I had never seen a case of Hib or measles. But now these diseases are making a comeback because of lower vaccination rates. And then talk about what you've seen in your own practice. If you've actually seen children who have vaccine-preventable disease, this is really a good opportunity to talk about that. Then again, once you've done those two steps, then it's time to launch into the science. These diseases have come back in areas where vaccination rates are low. Last year, 5 children died of Hib, and there were 5 cases of mumps that have been diagnosed in New York City. And those are the facts. And the explain and advise is, we care about our patients. We don't practice substandard care in our practice, and all of our patients need to be vaccinated. So our third example is Dr. Bob. I want to spread out the shots so they won't overwhelm my child's immune system. So here, the statement with which I think everyone can agree is, kids certainly get more shots today than they did years ago. That's true. The about me statement could be something like, our practice follows the CDC schedule because it's carefully designed to protect children at the time that they're most vulnerable to disease. I recently returned from a meeting where we talked about this, or I served on a committee that reviewed the schedule, or again, describe your personal experience with the vaccination schedule. Then get into the science. Although kids get more shots today, they actually receive fewer antigens than when they got fewer shots because technology has enabled us to make vaccines that have only the parts of the cell that induce the immune response. And if you want to use the drop in the ocean, I always like that. The immunological challenge from a vaccine is nothing compared to what kids fight off every day in the real world. And an ear infection is actually a much larger immunological challenge than a vaccine. Pretty much every child has had an ear infection and has lived to tell the tale. And then the final statement, the explain, is we want all of the kids in our practice to be immunized so that they have the greatest chance for a long and healthy life. So in addition to using this framework, we also recommend some other actions, anticipating parent concerns and answering their questions before they're asked. Again, this really shows that the practice is taking these issues very seriously, not waiting for parents to bring up concerns, but being proactive in their approach to this topic. So we would recommend that practices give out the CDC vaccine information sheets for upcoming shots, not just those that are given the day of. We recommend that vaccine education is part of prenatal classes or infant care classes that new moms might receive. We recommend meeting with small groups of parents to discuss vaccines together so that it's not an individual conversation over and over with individual parents or families. And we also recommend that practices meet with school staff because parents say that the number one place where they get their information about autism and vaccines is from school staff, particularly mothers of children in preschool said they rely on their child's preschool teacher to answer healthcare questions. So that's a little concerning because preschool teachers are not always up to date on the latest medical information. So I think it's now becoming very important to make sure that preschool teachers are receiving this information. So if there are opportunities for you to interact with preschools and preschool teachers in your community, that's a great way to get information out. That's sort of a train-the-trainer model. There are lots of great fact sheets and booklets that I've seen at the exhibit hall here, all of which can be used. We recommend posting, leaving those items in the waiting room, and also posting mainstream media on bulletin boards in the waiting room. Parents Magazine has a great article in the current edition, the May 2010 issue, about vaccines. That's a great one to display. Point-of-care materials have been developed by a lot of the not-for-profits that are exhibiting downstairs, by the CDC, by the NIH, by lots of groups. We recommend partnering with local researchers to disseminate research. A lot of them have newsletters and websites that can be redistributed and repurposed. You need not reinvent the wheel. I think all of these organizations are very happy to have their materials redirected and repurposed. And then point families towards message-compatible group websites. We hear a lot that parents want to get materials from other parent groups. So I think a great one is our organization, AutismScienceFoundation.org. We are founded by parents. And we have great information on our website, not just about autism research, but we have a whole section on autism and vaccines. And we have all of the studies there for parents to read if they're interested in reading the actual studies. So a lot of times you'll hear a parent will come in with a parent website printed out, and you can now refer them to another parent website. So again, our foundation, we're founded by parents of children with autism. We're focused on the science. We work closely with the major healthcare groups, the AAP, the CDC, the AAFP, the AMA, and we have specific information on our website about vaccines and autism. So I'm going to hand it over now to the next Allison. Thank you.